Mr. Valance, Real 11, we were talking about coming to the end of your time at Ypres, and the next thing really is the advance up to the crossing of the Rhine and then into Germany. What do you recall of that?
We moved up to our side of the Rhine a few days before the actual crossing.
Did you drive, or were you?
We went on transporters most of the way.
What were these? What were the tank transporters like?
Huge flatback lorries. We could drive a tank onto and lash it down. To save the track mines, because all the tanks had a limited track mine. Quite a feat of organisation, these huge lorries acquired from somewhere to then take us up. And we weren't involved, I don't think, on the actual crossing of the line, not on the first day, but we sat and watched this huge air armada.
Well, how impressive was it?
Oh, extremely. For about a week before that, there'd been a tremendous smoke barrage made along the line. So the Germans couldn't see what was going on our side. A huge smoke barrage, a scream of barrage. and that was kept up all the time. And at night, they had what was termed artificial moonlight, i.e. searchlights shining up into the sky to reflect some light down. And on the actual crossing, there was a tremendous barrage of the artillery and this huge air fleet overhead dropping the airborne. And I think we crossed the next day. And something went wrong. We crossed over the bridge.
What was it like? Because that in itself is not an easy thing, or it's quite an intimidating thing, as I believe, crossing a pontoon bridge across the Rhine. Because the bridge moves, doesn't it?
That's right.
What do you remember of it? Because you'd be right on the top, wouldn't you?
Well. Quite good fun, really. You get a nice view, and you just keep sure that the driver doesn't err at all.
Did it move about underneath you much?
Well, not so you would notice a lot, but you could see it was, you know, the thing was swaying and moving. It was quite a strong current on the line. Well, the street, how they got the thing across. Once we were across, we seemed to get lost somehow. Everybody, I think we milled around in circles looking for each other and so on. And I don't think we did much at all the first day. But then after that, we then did start to go forward a bit. I can remember one action at a place called Iberburen.
Iberburen.
IWBERUN.
What do you remember of that?
The infantry were held up. And we were ordered, and along the bridge with them, I forget which one, and we were ordered to go through them, to carry on. And A squadron were the leading squadron, and four troop were the leading troop. And I think I was the leading tank. And the road went through a high ridge or hill. The road went through it and over it and about approached where the road went up into the hill and were fired upon. And the ice farmers left, I remember, immediately. And then in a big circle left, put out some smoke, and then crossed the road again into the farm yard where it was up there in the camera. And then the other tanks in the two all swung off right where the ground was boggy, and they got bogged, which rather pleased me. And I remember there I was ordered by somebody to go on foot and see what was up there.
Now, who would resolve this gun? I mean, because would it be you, or because the others were all bogged down? What happened?
Well, I don't really know what happened. I think we all fired up there, and it stopped firing back. As we swung off, we swung the turret down to fire up where the gun was firing from. But it wouldn't stop, at least I wouldn't stop. And then you had to keep moving.
So you often would never resolve these things because you wouldn't go and see what had happened.
That's right.
So yeah. It stopped fire, that was the end of the problem.
Maybe that, but it could have been the vehicle that was firing at us that was doing that. It's what I mean, we thought we were all coming up the road, but we didn't go.
How would they get out of the bog?
Well, they would get another tank to pull them, or a recovery vehicle to pull them out. But each squad would have its own recovery vehicle with it. We were there then for several days.
Now, you said you had given an infantry. Sorry, yes, yeah. I interrupted you. What happened?
Well, I think there was somebody told me to go on foot and see if I could see what was up there. And I remember my driver came with me, and we crept up by the hedgerows and so on, and couldn't see a thing. So after that, I said, I think we've gone far enough. We went back and said we couldn't see anything. It wasn't our goal anyway. We felt very naked going up on foot. The infantry suffered dreadful casualties there, and I think Warren's infantry were disbanded after that. They had something like 300 casualties. It was a German army, the equivalent of our boys, Richard, military school from Hanover, who were fanatics who'd been put up to hold that bridge. They really did hang on like fanatics.
But your troop wasn't sent to attack them?
No.
And what's the next thing you remember? I know it's episodic, but yeah. That's how your memory is. It doesn't matter.
I think after a few days, we were ordered to go round to the flank, which we did without opposition, and we went round to the other side of this ridge. And it was open country, and no Germans there at all. It seemed so strange that all the casualties on the bridge itself, beyond it, there was nothing.
Had they pulled back by the time we did that?
Well, I think a lot of them were beyond pulling back. I suppose they had, yes. What we had done, we've missed a whole big episode out of this.
When was that?
When we still had the Shermans.
Right, let's drop it in now then. It's all right.
In Holland, in the Tiel country, which is a very flat country, and along the Maas, we had several weeks there in the autumn. I remember one day we were advancing over moorland, and in the Helmand area, and we came across a German parachute battalion, which had just been placed there, ready to go the line, and we drove in amongst them. And we took a few casualties, they took a lot of casualties, but the whole battalion, we were put in the bag.
That was a parachute, German parachute regiment.
Yes, they hadn't parachuted that. I had a boogie wheel blown off. My corporal, Corporal Barlow, he dropped a grenade in his turret and nearly it all on him.
Was that Barlow, your old driver?
Yes.
Ken Barlow.
Yes. He was the main commander. I remember going and getting him on the back of my tank and taking him back to where an ambulance was. And that was the last I saw him. Steele Brownlee, something happened to him, I can't remember what. Second in command of the squadron, Captain Shoot, who was shot in the throat, still bears the scars, but he did when he died a few years ago. He wore the scar after all the time.
Would you, in these circumstances, would you still have your hatch open when you were in amongst infantry like that?
Yes. Well, I would. The theorists would say don't. But
why would you have it open?
Well, A, I could see better. That is the main. And B, if you had to bail out, it would open and you could get out.
You weren't worried about them dropping grenades in? Or perhaps you were, but...
Yeah, they didn't. I don't know. Well, that's what happened to Ken Barlow. That was one little episode. But then we spent several weeks in, it was called the Peel Country, very flat and very boggy. And it was not far from the mass, and it was the front line. And we used to have, if I remember rightly, 4 days up in the line and 3 days back in a village. And the Dutch people were literally starving. They had no food, they shared our food. And the last day we were at a particular house, they said they would provide the meal, which they did. And it was a plate of peas. That was all it was, peas, and a little piece of meat, rather like rabbit, on the side, which was sadly their cat. If you saw the fur or the skin of it outside. But that was that side of it. But when we were in the mine, we were shelled all the time. At night we used to pull into a farm yard, nose to tail, and we slept in the barn. And then the first night, the fourth night, I just moved out a few hundred yards around wherever there was cover. Either from our left flank, which was where they were moving, looking down the side of the river. And if one moved in the daytime, you know, we're asking for trouble, you can walk anywhere. Went outside to leave us up, and the infantry was dotted all around us. And there were lots of incidents there. The girls used to walk through at night, then the University Patrol. I remember there was a crossroads, it's about a mile from where we were. And, at night we put a standing patrol out there where some six trenches were down, and the troop went down and stayed there all night. And the night it was our turn, they forgot to tell us. rather late at night when it was fully dark. I said, sorry, you're going to go down there. I wasn't still rowdy then, but it was Lieutenant Porter. He said, well, what's really? I said, well, it's no good. We can't all trundle down that road in the dark. So I said, I'll go. He said, well, I'll take somebody and we'll go ahead and see you. So he said, no, I'll come with you. So we told the rest of the troop to follow in 10 minutes. And we went down this road, very frightened. And eventually we came to where the sit trenches were. And so he went in one side of the road, I went in the other. And I heard, I settled in this trench, I heard footsteps in the field beside me. And I silently cocked a Stengel which I borrowed from somebody. And I trembled in this trench. And the footsteps were louder, nearer. Until eventually, looming right over my trench was a cow. And shortly after that, the rest of the troop came. We just spent an uncomfortable night there. These little incidents, they do come to mind.
Anything else in this Dutch period, Holland?
Sorts of dreadful things happened. I didn't see it, but the ground was very, very boggy. And that one crew, I think not in Adam, slept underneath the tank. And then the tank settled on them, and they were killed.
Did you ever sleep under the tank?
Oh, yes, we did, but not in the Peel County. It was too boggy. Oh, yes, well, everywhere, pretty well.
So you wouldn't use a bivouac at the side of the tank thing?
No. If there was any shelling or anything about it, just dig quite a biggish hole, 6 foot long and about 4 or 5 feet wide, run the tank over it, sleep in that. And it felt secure.
So that's about nothing else about Holland at the moment? Or?
No, that's it.
In that case, we'll move back to Germany, you've just done the Iberuret, Iberuret, yes, that's it. What happened after that? I know you passed close to the concentration camp at Belsen.
Yes, we did.
Were you aware of it?
Yes, we were warned about it the day before.
What did they warn you of? I mean, what did they warn you of?
Well, the Germans had asked for an armistice, 24 hours, or in that area, because they said that there's a concentration camp and there's typhus. And but I suppose it was Monty refused it. They wouldn't do it. We just skirted round the edge of it, but we were warned not to mix with any people, or even if we saw them outside, we were not to give them anything, because we could catch typhus, although we were, I think, inoculated against it.
And were you aware of conditions in the camp, or did you? Some people have said there was a smell. I don't know whether you were aware of.
I don't recall it. We were aware, I mean, but it's very difficult to decide what was rumour and which was truth at the time. We so horrific one didn't really believe that it could possibly be true. And of course it was. But as I say, I didn't actually go into the camp at all.
What about your reception from German civilians, if there were any about?
Oh, not friendly. Not friendly, and sullen. But wherever we went, wherever we advanced before we got there, there was white flags were put out in every window. But it could still be fired upon. It didn't make us particularly friendly.
Any more actions after that?
Well, yes, we were. I mean, we were continually in action, meeting the odd tank, not many, and groups of infantry with the
bazookas.
Bazookas. Mm. Yes, we had all sorts of little skirmishes and so on. But all the time we kept advancing. We were never forced to retreat at all.
Who would be dealing with German Tigers at this stage? Would they be dealt with by the RAF, or were you still required as a unit to deal with Tigers or Panthers?
Well, there weren't many about at this stage. But if we were required to deal with them, yes, we would definitely.
Did you have specific tactics for specific types of German tank? I mean, like the Tiger, for instance, which had such a reputation.
Keep away from it. No, we didn't have specific tactics. But, I mean, what was one tactic, if you saw that, was to get the gunners on top. Because you couldn't bring them out.
The Royal Artillery?
Yes. And they were very, very effective. Just had, within each squadron, you had an OP from the in a tank, and they would point out to him that he stands very number, which we did with great effect.
So they'd be, the artillery is going to be more use than your own,
well, against
a tank.
Tiger, certainly.
Your gun, even with the
76. Well, no, the 76 was pretty good, but the Tiger was an enormous thing. And that had an enormous capital.
But it would be the Royal Artillery rather than the RAF you'd look to.
Well, we could also. We did also call on the RAF, the Typhoons, who would be circling up above if the weather was clear, and give them references, and they would come down and see what happened.
Did the Tiger have a tremendous reputation?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Tiger was the equivalent of a battleship. And,
what about the Panther? What do you think of that?
Well, that was more on our own level. We thought they were very, very good. But once we had the Comets.
It was better than the Sherman then.
We were then more or less on a level playing field than the Panther.
So you'd be better then than the Mark IV?
Oh yes. Yeah.
By then?
Yeah.
Would the Sherman be more the equivalent to the Mark IV? Or was it? Not even the Mark IV?
Yeah, because Mark IV had a better gun. And the Sherman, well, really had a look at it and it blew up.
What about, was the 76mm better than the Firefly Sherman, the 17-pounder, was it?
About the same, yes.
So not much, yeah. No, it's all right. What about, I forgot to ask, this Lieutenant Porter, had he taken over Steel Brownlee's troop at this stage?
Yes, he did. I forget exactly which stage.
What was he like?
Just a young lad.
You had you had more experience than him at the time? Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think I taught him for the first 2 or 3 weeks.
Did he make that easy for you to do? I mean, some people can be, make it very difficult to give advice.
No, very easy. No problem.
Did you respect him in turn?
Oh, yes. I don't know a lot more what went on in all divisions, but in their division, certainly, as far as our troop was concerned, we were just one close-knit family. Rank really didn't come into it a lot. I mean, people were impressed by their rank and so on, but I mean, one thought as much of say, a gunner as a trooper as you did of your troop leader as an officer. People were very close together.
Well, did you ever think of going for a commission yourself? I mean, surely you could have done as well as... You had to train him, or...
Well...
Could you not have done as well as Porter yourself, or...
No, I never in my head, then. But much later, strange, it did come up, but... no, not then. I've never intended to stay with
him. Well, we'll come on to that. So, he was in your... Was he... he was a good officer, then?
Oh, yeah. Well, if they weren't good, they didn't last.
What happened to them?
Well, they were sent back somewhere else.
Who by?
No. Would it be the leader and the commanding officer? They were sent back to do some other job. But that didn't happen.
Did people get more nervy as the end of the war approached? You know, this idea of nearly being there.
To a degree, yes. It was obvious that the war was rapidly breaking away. One felt quite a bit unfortunate to catch it at the last moment. A friend of mine, Corporal Bush, he was killed just in the week the war ended, and he had
What happened to him? Were you there?
Yes, I was just beside him, just down the road. He was in the lead, and he was ordered to cross the road. And as he did, a German anti-tank gun fired down the road. He stopped and bailed out, and of course, gun fired his second shot, an AT exploded, caught him, killed him. I helped to bury him, which was very, very sad. But so one did get. Well, at that stage, yes, one did think, we've made it, almost.
Did that affect the way you behaved yourself?
No, not really, I don't think.
You weren't more cautious?
Well, I didn't volunteer for anything. No, but I mean, I was very young then. I think the older chaps felt it more.
Were there any last actions, or was that Bush's one? Was that the last action?
That was about the last. We went up. Our last action was to dash up the motorway to Lubeck.
You actually went along the motorway, didn't you?
Yes.
What was that like? It seems strange, though.
Very fun. We were going along as far as we could go.
Were you chewing it up at all, track?
No. We were going along one lane as fast as we could go, about 30 miles an hour. And two German staff cars came up the other one and overtook us until somebody shot them. And we were then ordered to occupy both lanes. And we went into Quebec, and there were thousands and thousands of German civilians fleeing from the Russians. And they were on all sorts of vehicles, rather like you see in the Kosovo business today. Lorries driving, no tires, and on wheels, all right out. And that was that. Then from